Supervised bodywork on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the two front fenders were made from Ford trimotor fenders.
Really?
The aluminum stampings, which covered the front of the wheels on the Ford trimotor landing gear, we cut them off and pieced them out and made some very nice extended fenders for the car. Yeah.
Yes.
And so we finished the car up to that extent, and I sent it over to the Lincoln plant and had some nice trim put in it and mm-hmm. had it painted Mr. Ford's favorite gunmetal gray. And
mm-hmm.
and along in January, in February, I guess it was, that'd be February 1935, we talked about the possibility of having it built or the putting it into production through one of the custom bodybuilders. Well, we'd furnish the chassis and the custom bodybuilder would provide the bodywork and finish it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be sponsored by Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thought, I contacted the outfit down in Pennsylvania. But, well, anyway, I suggested to Mr. Ford that we drive it down to New York and show it to Johnny Inskip, who he was very well acquainted with.
Now, who was he?
Inskip was manager of the Brewster plant and also the Rolls-Royce agent in New York, and he was an old friend of Mr. Ford. Yeah.
And you knew him also.
That's right, that's right. And Brewster had built some custom-built Ford Town Cars, extended frame Ford Town Cars under the
yes.
name Brewster.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether Mr. Ford had a financial interest in that or not, but they built them for a couple of years, mm-hmm. and they were quite attractive.
33, cars. 34.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And
very attractive radiator.
Yeah, it looked like a New York taxi cab, those flared front fenders, you know.
Yes, right.
I don't know where they came from. That wasn't a better part of it, but the workmanship was nice. The mm-hmm. cars were.
Yes.
I think they sold for about $5,000, something like that.
Very limited edition.
About half what you'd pay for a pickup truck today, I think. Well, anyway, I took the car down there, drove it down there in the dead of winter with one of my buddies there, and we didn't have any heat in the thing, and we just had side curtains on it, and gee, the snow was flying around, and it was a rough trip. We hadn't had plenty of Applejack with us. I don't know, we never made it. But anyway, we got down there, and I discussed it with Inskip, and Inskip's apparent idea was that Mr. Ford was interested in financing a factory arrangement down there, you know, set him up in a big way with a new factory.
Mm-hmm.
They already had the old Brewster five-story plant over in Bridge Plaza in Long Island City. And but when I came back and told Mr. Ford the story, why he wasn't interested in setting up a factory or anything of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, he gave me the car. Mr. Ford gave me the car, which I enjoyed very much.
What happened to it?
I used it for a couple of years. I kept the car, and oh, yes, I drove it around, made several trips down east with it. Beautiful car.
Did you sell it?
I finally sold it.
Mm-hmm.
$500.
Oh!
A friend of mine on the island, you know, he uh-huh. couldn't wait to get that car. Thought I wouldn't have taken $50,000 for it today.
Oh. You think... have you traced it? Is it still
yes, in existence? Yes. An interesting little story about it.
I'd love to hear it.
I picked up an old cars magazine, that paper that's printed up in
old
Minnesota,
Car Weekly?
Wisconsin. Yeah.
Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
And here's a picture of the car on the front page, a mystery car, it said.
No.
And they didn't know whether it was an English Jensen or it was this or that. It was some sort of a Ford experimental car and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did get around to write and tell them what it was. Somebody put a crazy top on it, and they all wind up in California, it seems, those special built cars. Two or three of them that I built.
Do they still not know that what it is?
No, they don't know. I don't know what happened to it. Well, anyway, that summer, following summer, Mr. Ford went to England.
Mm-hmm.
And
Edsel Ford. Yes. That was in the summer of
35?
Okay.
Yeah, summer of 35.
Mm-hmm.
While he was over there, he made some arrangements with the Jensen.
Yes.
English Jensen Company over there, who built sports cars and
custom
used...
Custom sports cars.
Yeah, that's right. They mm-hmm. used certain Ford components, Ford mm-hmm. engines and whatnot.
Right.
And he made an arrangement with them to use this chassis, this particular chassis design mm-hmm. that I had developed.
Mm-hmm.
And we built two more hand-built chassis and shipped them from the Lincoln plant, crated them up, shipped them from the Lincoln plant to England.
Mm-hmm.
And he sold them on the idea the components were to be altered and the conversion parts would have been made in the Dagenham plant, mm-hmm. I think.
Where was the Jensen plant, do you know?
It was up in the, it wasn't in London, it wasn't close to London, it was somewhere, Derby or not, well, that's the Rolls plant. I can tell you, I have it on in mm-hmm. one of the write-ups.
Okay.
But but he sold them on the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a, he sent me a photo and a catalog of the car showing the chassis of the, that I designed and whatnot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And signed by him, and I got it out back. So that was, they used that chassis up until the war, up until production stopped in 39. So that was as far as that went.
Tell me about the Jensen Fords. They were quite popular, especially among movie stars.
Yeah, that's right, that's right, that's right, that's right. You've seen pictures of them.
Yes,
yeah,
mm-hmm. uh-huh. They were gorgeous.
Very nice, and they used some Hudson at one time. They converted, they used a Hudson chassis prior to the Ford chassis. And Hudson motor or some darn thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was a fabricated or assembled mm-hmm. proposition.
So how many years did the Jensens have the tie-up with Ford?
Well, from 1935 until, I guess, 39, when the war started, they stopped production entirely, of course. And,
but it was a limited edition.
Oh, yes, yes. I don't know. They probably built a few hundred a year, something like that.
But, on special order.
Yes, yeah. At least the car wound up fruitfully.
Mm-hmm. They used your special chassis?
Yeah, that's right.
What motor did they use in it?
They used a regular Ford V8.
Motor,
yeah. The wheelbase was extended about 10 inches, and it lowered the chassis down. But the feature of this thing was there was no basic change. By the time 35 rolled around, Ford had a lower chassis level due to pushing the engine forward
mm-hmm.
in the chassis and a higher kick-up so that we didn't have to change the rear end,
mm-hmm.
but they used the special front-end suspension, which involved extending the radius rod, leaving the cross spring, transverse front spring, where it was entirely, mm-hmm. not disturbing it, but it was carried on the radius rod.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bridge built into the radius rod, uh-huh. which carried the spring shackles,
mm-hmm.
so that it didn't disturb the spring. The steering box was not disturbed, just lengthened the drag link.
Right.
Nothing mechanically was changed at all, except that it lowered the car down, lengthened the wheelbase 10 inches,
mm-hmm.
gave you a better ride, nicer handling,
mm.
beautiful, beautiful suspension. And
this was in 35?
That was in 35, I'll show you a catalog of the car.
Mm, I see.
Showing you
mm-hmm.
a note he wrote to me about it. Well, by the time, let's see, it was in November, 39, that the thought came to us. We began discussing a special-built car again, and of course Mr. Ford's initial thought on this special-built car was to be a Ford, to glorify the Ford line.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever the suggestion of building that car in a Ford plant or interrupting Ford production in any way, which would have done the Rouge plant fought us on it. It was just a nuisance value. Anything that would interrupt Ford production.
You had quite a bit of problem with people like
Sorensen and
Charlie
Pete Sorensen, Martin.
Pete Martin.
Sure, yeah.
Martin.
All service, the production people.
Yeah. Bill Especially Peacock since you were working for Edsel Ford.
They considered it a frivolous gesture on Mr. Ford's part.
Right.
Anything that I refer to as being frivolous.
Yes.
I think
right.
they did too. That's the term they used today.
Any artistic or in good taste.
That's the term they use today, frivolous. In other words, a lot of crap, see?
Right, yeah.
So the boy gives the boy something to tinker
right.
with, see?
Exactly, right, yeah.
So Edsel Ford and I talked the thing over every few days or every week or so, and we finally got up to the Mercury. Would it be feasible to do it with the Mercury? Well, there again, we're up against the same problem with the production plants. There's no place in a production plant for it without creating dissension and problems, see? No one could see a profit in it. And so at this point, an idea struck me. The old K model Lincoln
mm-hmm.
was being phased out,
mm-hmm.
had been phased out.
Right.
And we had one whole bay along Livernois Avenue, the Lincoln plant,
mm-hmm.
where a certain amount of custom work had been done on these custom bodies that had come in. We had a nucleus of custom body workers at the Lincoln plant, mm-hmm. maybe a couple hundred of them,
mm-hmm.
that did custom trim work, custom paint work.
Oh.
In the custom bodies after they arrived and mounted on the old K model chassis, see? Mm-hmm. So the idea struck me, I said, gee, here we've got the Zephyr over there. We've got our engine components. It's all under one roof. And we have one whole bay of this plant that's not being used.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, without going into that phase of it with Mr. Ford, maybe I discussed it briefly,
mm-hmm.
but I sketched up, I took a tent size blueprint,
mm-hmm.
a catalog, what they refer to as a salesman's handbook print,
mm-hmm.
reduced down, showing the overall dimensions and headroom and all that, you know. And I took a yellow crayon pencil, and I sketched in a lower hood. And
you're taking a Zephyr.
Zephyr sedan.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And moved the windshield back.
Mm-hmm.
Lowered the steering gear. All those things were just what like you'd do if you were trying to draw a fancy version of an ugly car. So you know what you do to change it. See.
Yeah.
So, well, the things that came to mind at that point were that the chassis didn't need lowering. You see, the Zephyr was designed with the concept of a chair-high seat.
Mm-hmm. Like at one point they had
a chair-high seat, about an 18-inch seat in the thing, see?
Mm-hmm.
And the floor pan was very low, very mm-hmm. shallow. The car didn't have much of a side rail because of unit construction. It had a very shallow, like a bed rail, maybe 3-inch side rail, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The sill, you know.
Right.
And I thought, well, we've already got a car that's down fairly low, mm-hmm. the foundation of it, the pan, see? So I drew this thing up and sketched in the roof line and the little trunk on the back and whatnot. And that afternoon, Edsel Ford came by and his usual visit. And I said, how do you like this? He said, oh boy, that looks great. Mm-hmm. Looks good. So I said, well, how about making a little model? I said, we'll make a little tent size model, you know, 17, 18 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
So I had Gene Adams, his trade school boy there, I said, let's make a profile template of this
mm-hmm.
for modeling, see? So I had him glue it on a piece of masonite, you know, pressed wood, 1/8 masonite,
mm-hmm.
glued it on there with some rubber cement, and then he prick punched the profile and put it in a jigsaw and sorted it out, see?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that was the only drawing that was ever made of the goddamn car. As little as people think, when I tell them it was designed in 35 minutes, why, well, that's God's honest truth, see?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. The profile was like John Barrymore's profile, and that's what sort. He said, that's it, boom, see? It was all that was ever made. It was a crude profile little sketch.
Was this 38?
This was in 39.
Early 39.
No, this was in probably in November 39.
November 39.
Yeah, along mm-hmm. in November, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you liked it immediately?
We had this little tent-sized scaling bridge, and we modeled it right in my office on a little table.
Mm-hmm.
And Gene Adams and I modeled it right up with our hands. I worked right on it with him, and,
mm-hmm.
and we used the little scaling bridge. Of course, we had the front end, see?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a whole car design. We had the front end.
From the Zephyr.
Of the Zephyr.
Yes.
That was the new 38 front end, which is real slick. See, mm-hmm. that is a slick front end.
Right.
And the fenders were reasonably decent, so we just pieced the fenders out didn't do a thing with the rear fender. I think we used the standard rear fender
mm-hmm.
and did the little tire on the back, you know, and made this pretty little model.
Tell us more about the tire on the back, because that has become the hallmark of the Continental.
Yeah, well, I was part of the package. I mean, it was...
But was this your idea, or did Mr. Ford like the idea from a Continental he had seen earlier?
I can't say. I just can't pinpoint that.
Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, it appeared on there. I don't know whether it was his idea or mine. I just mm-hmm. can't say at this point. Well, it was immediately acceptable to him.
And it was a collaboration.
That's right. Okay, let's make it that way. And that was part of the package.
Mm-hmm.
So we did this little model up and painted his favorite gray with white sidewalls and nice mm-hmm. little chrome bumpers and all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this all took maybe a week. And he said, well, how long will it take to get one ready? He said, I'd like to see if we can get one ready for my vacation when I go to Hope Sound, see?
Sure.
So we went right ahead and turned the thing over to Martin Rigitko, and we made a little scaling bridge. took the offsets off, you know.
That's incredible.
Put them on a sheet.
You adapted the large scaling bridge to a model scaling bridge.
That's right. Uh-huh. Took the offsets off with a tent size scaling bridge.
Right.
Turned the figures over to Martin Rigetko, and he made a paper draft, just a rough paper draft of it, full size. And sent it over to the Lincoln plant and went ahead and built one just as quick as we could, see?
This is about December.
By that time, it would have been December or January. Well, anyway, by March, late February, we had the car finished, ready to ship down there by truck.
You shipped it down by truck?
Yeah. Have you seen pictures of the car, Norm?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
And it was a pretty thing, but the man was all full of solder and heavy, you know, and leaked like a sieve. But
yeah.
I mean, it was beautiful to look at, but I mean, it was strictly a handmade mock-up sort of thing, see?
Right.
Yeah. Well, he guess he'd had the car down there for a couple of weeks, and he called me on the phone one day, and he said, "Well, he said, gosh, I've driven this car around Palm Beach, and he said I could sell 1,000 of them down here right away, quick." He says they couldn't get enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, "You better get over to the Lincoln plant and talk with Robbie over there. He was the Lincoln superintendent over there, and see what you can do to set up an arrangement for limited production, you know, just some arch presses and whatnot, and so he could build a few hundred of these to start off with." So he said, in the meantime, he said, "You better get a second one going right away, a second-hand built one."
Right.
To work out mechanical details like the steering column shift, who was just coming in for production on the production car at that time. Which I went over, and Robbie and I sat down. We got going right away quick. I said, "The boss man said we should build a second one of these." And he said, "Oh, God, not that again." I said, "This is, I think it's going to gel this time, see? I think we got something here." So, well, at that point, I told Mr. Ford, I said, then we got talking about the advantages of building it as a Lincoln. I said, "In the first place, we can get more money for this car." This was after he decided just for a one-off, see? This is prior to his calling me back to build more of them.
Yes.
And I sent him away with that germ in his mind, see? I said, "Gee, we've got the chassis frame, we've got the suspension system, we got the engine, we've got the steering gear. All we got is the sheet metal work, the rest of the sheet metal work to make custom carbon. We're not interfering with any Ford production. Everything, got all the components in-house right there at the Lincoln plant,
perfect,
see?
Yes.
And we got the people to do the nice trim work and so on." So it was a natural, it just fell together that way. And so, of course, the rest is history. I mean, it went into production, and Mickey Rooney got the first one. And at that time, he was out there getting thrown off the train for Tom Edison or some damn thing, you know. The movie man was out there. The director I got to know pretty well. Was it Clarence Brown?
Yes.
Yeah. Mickey Rooney got the first one. It was a dark green, dark Brewster green.
We have a marvelous account written by Jack Davis of the day that they drove the car up to the MGM lot and gave it to Mickey Rooney.
Oh, was that right?
And we got pictures of him.
Oh.
He had just come from an Andy Hardy set, and he had a tuxedo on.
Yeah.
He couldn't believe his eyes. He said, "Gosh, Mr. Davis, this is fabulous. Gee, wait till the guys see me driving around in this."
Yeah.
I believe there'll be a story on that coming up in one of the on the upcoming Lincoln Continental magazines.
Yeah. Well, that's the story of the Lincoln Continental, and it was as simple as that. And there were no drawings made other than that one little marked-up blueprint. When I tell people, we went to a Lincoln Continental, they have these get-togethers all over the country, you know, here.
Yes.
A couple of years ago, they here in St. Augustine, and up at the Ponce Lodge, and they asked me up there to talk to them about the car and all that kind of thing. And I told them, I said, "You know, this is the quickest designed car on record," and they couldn't believe it. I said, "Gee, it couldn't have been over a half hour, an hour at the most to make that little profile sketch of it."
Right.
That's all the design work there was.
Marvelous.
I said, "We had the parts and we just put them together." With no idea that the car would create the sensation that it did. And one of the reasons it was a sensation was it was bereft of trim. We had no tooling for trim. There was no trim we could put on it. We kept it clean and neat, just fine surface lines.
Right.
See?
Well, you did have some problems with mechanics. You talked about the lead solder.
Oh, well,
and so
no, that was on that handmade.
Oh, the handmade car.
Yeah. It was, you know, it was a lot of solder on it, and lot of rush work to finish it up. Edsel told me, he said, boy, it leaks like a sieve and it weighs, oh God, it must have had 500 pounds of lead on it. And the engine, you don't know, it was a no damn good engine. It was a sorry engine. It was a mush. It was just mush. Well, you know, there's another interesting story in connection with that front end. Who was it was talking to me? I don't know, one of the automobile people here a while back. He said that Harley Earl was over in Paris, the automobile show in Paris. And then time the announcement of that car came out. And they showed him a picture of that front end on that 38 Zephyr. And he said, my God, he said, how did we miss on that one? He said, that's going to ruin us, see? Well, let me tell you the funny thing about that front end. I wasn't designed to style a car. Not at all. Old Frank Johnson, the old Lincoln engineer, you know, he came from Leland. He was, oh God, he was an old grandpappy. He started out with Leland. Way back in...
1919?
Yeah, 1909, earlier than that, 1910 and 12.
Oh, back in the old Cadillac days.
Old Cadillac. He's an old design, the old four-cylinder Cadillac.
All right, fine.
Fine old gentleman, gee. Old pot-bellied guy with a blue serge suit and always went around a vest and his little pince-nez glasses. And he, as he talked, he'd say, see, kind of a nervous habit, you know. And the 37, the first 37 front end I designed.
Which I want to talk about.
Yeah, that
gorgeous
was...
Gorgeous car.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I don't think it was one of our best design efforts. But anyway, it sold the car to Edsel Ford. They were at a standstill at Briggs. Shall I keep on from there?
Please, yes.
When Briggs had sold Edsel Ford and the idea of building this truss frame unit construction streamlined Zephyr type car as a follow up to Chrysler's Airflow, a modernized version of it. They got as far as the front end of the car. They had Edsel Ford sold on the body and the concept of the car mechanically and whatnot, except for the rear engine. John Jada had laid the car out. He was a rear engine fan and had laid it out with the rear engine. That didn't sell.
He'd done a prototype for the 34-year World's Fair.
That's right. That's right. And that didn't go over with Mr. Ford at all. So they used the conventional driveline, conventional, I guess it was nothing but Ford axle, and cross springs and all that. And so they got as far as the windshield. And Jada had designed a more appropriate front end for that type of car, more like a VW, mine of a sheep's nose sloping thing, you know.
This TJAARD.
That's right, John Jada, And John was a designer salesman for Briggs. And I knew him very well. And Edsel Ford asked me to go over there one morning. They were right at a crossroads. They'd held up production and the tooling on this thing. And they couldn't satisfy him with the front of the car. So I didn't have anything to do with it up at that point. So he asked me to go over there, see if I could work out a front end that would appeal to him. So I sat there one morning in the back of a blueprint, as I usually did, and sketched with a big old pencil, and I sketched up a front end. He wanted sharp front end. He wanted a grill. He didn't want this plow nose arrangement, see?
This is Edsel Ford?
Yeah. He wanted a pointy grill. He loved pointy shapes. And no matter how you talk to him, I mean, the more they try to sell him on this other thing, the worse he got. He's obstinate on the subject. So I sketched up this pointed front end, you know, with a kind of a inverted boat hood. He liked those shapes. I knew he liked those shapes.
Right.
Okay, well, we got along that far fine. So I sketched up that front end. Well, anyway, the front end was quite wide at the top, see, right under the lid. It was quite wide, and it tapered down quite narrow, maybe 8-10 inches at the bottom, down at bumper level. Well, it so happened at that time, on all the Ford products, the Zephyr and both the Ford have the fan on the end of the crankshaft. See, the fan was mounted right on the crankshaft instead of up on the water pump with a belt driver, and it drove right off the crankshaft, see. Well, the net result was that they weren't getting very efficient cooling with the fan down that low instead of meeting up the hot part of the radiator core. And out in Arizona and Texas, they were getting complaints And old Frank Johnson, the old Lincoln engineer, would come to me about twice a week and say, Bob, can't we do something about get some more air to this car? And, you know, we're having trouble pulling trailers and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So he was overheating.
Mm-hmm.
So I was coming back from lunch one day, and there was a Zephyr chassis, what mounted to the chassis, sitting out there with the side rails way out here, and
mm-hmm.
skinny, tall radiator car sticking up here with a header tank on top of it. And I took my scale out and I measured, and I said, it should fit right crossways,
mm-hmm.
see, between the side rails. And I went back in the drafting office there, and I had one of my boys. I said, gee, get a great big old hunk of vellum out, and let's sketch up a radiator core sitting in there, thwartship, see?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we'll be able to cool this thing. Let's put the radiator core down in front of the fan, in other words. So, Ed Ford came in that afternoon, and I told him, you know, what we were doing there.
Mm-hmm.
He took a quick look at it, and he said, well, gee, maybe we can help Frank along that way. Maybe we can cool this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the boys whip together some rough sheet metal work and just piece it together with little pop rivets and all. We put it in a wind tunnel, and we ran it, you know, standard air to boil temperature and
mm-hmm.
under full load. And gee, it cooled fine. It was just a rough bunch of sheet tin, you know.
Yeah.
But the opening was down crossways in front of the core, see? And Edsel Ford said, well, let's go ahead and see what we can do with it. So we went ahead, and I had a front end clayed up. Old Dick Nike and some of the boys, and we clayed up the front end with the two grills, you know,
mm-hmm.
quite low.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be a right nice looking grill.
Was.
Well, anyway, that was the, of course, Edsel Ford okayed it right away for the 38 Zephyr.
Ah.
And in the meantime, it became a styling sensation.
Mm-hmm.
See, Packard copied it, you know, and
right.
Buick copied it. In the meantime, they still had the great big tall core with the fan up high,
mm-hmm.
and they went to all kinds of shrouding and sheet metal work to get the air from up high to go in down below to create the same cooling effect.
Mm-hmm.
They all thought it was a styling deal, see?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know why I did it, but it was to correct this damn cooling problem, see?
Incredible.
Well, that's another one of the little things you run into.
You had a marvelous front end on the 37 Ford.
Yeah.
Was that your inspiration?
The 37. No. But that was taken from the 30. That was taken from the first Zephyr.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, Briggs did that.
Oh, they did that.
Mr. Ford insisted they get something close to the first Zephyr.
Ah.
So it, from the grill and the hood, it was the same thing, see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except the low grill. Except the pinched in part. Well, it was pinched in.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where that came from.
Ah, okay.
That's the last Ford that Briggs had anything to do with. In other words, they did the 35 and 36 and 37.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the last, and then after that, all that stuff was pulled out of Briggs and all handled in our department.
So in 1935, you had effectively started the Ford Styling Studio, hadn't you?
Yes, yeah.
But Ford's direction?
That's right, but all that work was underway at Briggs at that time.
I see, so yeah, the system transferred it over to
that's
the
right.
engineering laboratory.
Yeah, Briggs had done the body, and they were building the body, and they did the front end, and
mm-hmm.
and so on.
But from now on?
from there on, we did the 38, 39, all the rest from there on, yeah. Uh-huh. The body was the same, you see, that
mm-hmm.
that old body shell went back, I guess, to 35, the whole cross-section of the body,
mm-hmm.
floor pan, and, you know, roof line and all. So it was just a front end, was a facelift deal.
I want to hear more about the Continental, but would this be a good point chronologically to insert the story of the Mercury, the development of the Mercury? Would you trace that?
Well, the Mercury really wasn't much to it. It was just a variation of the Ford,
right.
A little more pleasing body lines.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as we were concerned, it was just a blown-up Ford.
But why was there perceived that you needed a slightly larger...
To fill in the pricing gap. I mean, there was nothing. It was about a $500 spread, which was a lot in those days, between
mm-hmm.
between the Zephyr. The Zephyr was around $1,200 then,
mm-hmm.
just a base price for the Zephyr. And the Ford was around $950, somewhere in that bracket.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing in between there. It was probably a $400 spread.
Uh-huh.
And The mercury was the answer. In other words, we have to do a Pontiac or a DeSoto deal. Matter of fact, I've got charts that Ed Martin had drawn up my department. They're showing the spread in pen and ink. I've got them out there now,
mm-hmm,
in
right.
the box,
mm-hmm.
Showing the spread on and showing other competitive cars, you know, in that price range.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to get that stuff together, you know, and present it. See,
mm-hmm.
we were doing market research
as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, my God! I used to get the advertising displays. The sketches would come in, you know, for billboards and catalogs and God, some of those horrible artwork. I mean, the steering wheel was all twisted around, the wheels look cockeyed, and I'd take a big piece of vellum and lay over there. It got so they were passing all that stuff across my desk, and I'd spend a half a day or a day redoing these beautiful artwork, but perspectives were wrong.
Right.
They didn't have an eye for the right perspective. Mm-hmm. They didn't look right. They were twisted. The cars were a little twisted and humped up and all kinds of funny shapes.
Mm-hmm.
But I always loved to draw perspectives. Gosh, I could draw cars up on grease racks, you know, and show the underside of it and the whole damn thing.
That's
right.
That's a gift. Yeah.
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 And it didn't sit too well with some of my boys in the office either. Mm-hmm. They didn't like me to do that, you know. It's a funny thing. Some of their professional jealousy was... I had one boy I hired there, Ross Cousins.
Mm-hmm.
Ross Cousins' father had been quite a prominent illustrator, mm-hmm. you know, advertising illustrator.
Right.
And what I wanted, I came up with this concept. Instead, a lot of the designers were good designers, but couldn't draw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they couldn't make a presentation drawing.
Right.
And the idea occurred to me one day, gee, I'm going to hire an illustrator, a man that does these professional-looking jobs, you know,
yeah.
and we'll give him a drawing and let him doll it up and look see the hell out of his old Charlie Sorensen used to say, see?
And do what?
To look see the hell out of it,
okay.
See?
Mm-hmm.
So I got Ross Cousins and he was good. He could make nice drawings, you know, showing the car in front of a butcher shop and the mm-hmm. gal stepping out there and the guy putting the groceries in the mm-hmm. back and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
We designers don't know how to do that, you know, showing it in front of a country club. And it was quite a nice way to do it. And I just give Ross a drawing or a sketch, you know, and mm-hmm. or he'd do it from the model of the car, you know, it was modeled up, see?
Right.
And Ross got to, he got to putting his name into all these illustrations, see? And I had people call me from some different places and said, is Ross the new designer there? He said, I didn't give a damn. And Ross got the idea that people were telling him, you know, that he was the designer, see?
Yeah.
And they see his signature under these different drawings, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, what was that guy in California we were talking about?
Willis Wagner?
Not Willie, but the guy who writes the car stories, Mike Lynn.
Mike Lynn, yeah.
And he said, is Ross Cousins a designer? I said, no, he's a damn good illustrator. I said, he does the same work that these people that do for General Motors, you know, the catalog people, see?
Mm-hmm.
We used to have a whole group of those people draw up catalog illustrations and do beautiful work. But Russ got to where he, man, anybody suggest he was just illustrating the car, he got huffy about it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he was a prima donna, you know, see?
He began to believe his own press notice.
He did nice work. But he got awful, man, anybody tell him he was just an illustrator, he kind of got the idea that he was the designer, see?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't give a damn, as long as it looked right, we could sell it to Mr. Ford. That was a good move. We were able to do some nice work.
If in 1935-36 the Briggs era ended in terms of Ford design, and
mm-hmm.
and it all came under your aegis.
Yeah.
And you established yourself as you had been at the engineering laboratory.
Mm.
Did you enlarge the design department?
Oh yeah, department? Yeah. We started out right away. As soon as Edsel Ford called from Hope Sound, he called Charlie Sorensen
mm-hmm.
and told him to get together with me and provide any alterations in the building that were necessary mm-hmm. to enlarge the quarters and Sorensen came up and he was sweet as honey, you know, he's usually a hard boiled bastard.
Mm, yeah.
And boy, there was syrup going to pour out of his mouth and he's sweeter than that.
He got gotten the word.
He said, yes, he says, anything the boy wants, why, you just told me, and I'll fix it up for you, see? So,
so I've always got along fine with Charlie Sorensen. He was a boatman, you know. He loved boats, and he had a nice big yacht called the Helene.
Down on up for Miami Beach, or?
No, he used to keep it up at Algonac. He lived on the summer.
Yes.
And he lived in an apartment there at the Whittier in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm, right.
But he lived on this big 146-foot yacht in the summer.
Uh-huh.
And he had it built at Bath Ironworks in Bath, Maine. About 1931.
Mm-hmm.
I used to buy the boat up there, flats there.
Mm.
But I always got along all right with Charlie.
Good.
And well, you know, once these henchmen knew that I worked with poor Edsel Ford and,
mm-hmm.
and was able to please him and get things done, why they didn't give me any trouble. They growl a little bit, you know, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I usually wouldn't maneuver my way around them. It was a kind of a change for them, you know. It was a new experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally had to realize that the design of the car, the so-called styling of the car, was just about important. As I pointed out, a hell of a lot more important than selling the customer as to whether the car had a straddle-mounted axle pinion or whether it had roller bearings, the ball bearings and the wheels or what have you. They bought the car in appearance. And
did you have a problem with Henry's edict against certain modern mechanical devices like the hydraulic brakes? And but you had those on the Lincoln, though.
No, they had mechanical brakes. Matter of fact, I guess I'm trying to think of when the I think it was about 37 or 38 the hydraulic brakes came in
on Lincoln.
And the Mercury.
And the Mercury.
Yeah, I think it was right along.
On the Ford, not until 1939 or 40.
40, yeah.
Yeah, 40.
I had nothing to do with that. That was all chassis.
Yeah. Okay.
Larry
good.
Sheldrick and I didn't get into that phase of it at all.
Yeah.
I used to listen to the stories. And,
I can imagine. Tell me about the, one of the styling innovations.
Yeah, I frequently would have a lot of the mechanical people from the chassis, Sheldrick and different ones, come to me
mm-hmm.
to prompt me to sell Mr. Ford on some of these things. See,
yes.
They knew that Mr. Ford and I discussed these things, and
mm-hmm.
they would take me out and give me a sales pitch, see, on
sure.
some of these things. I'd drive the cars home, you know, weekends with a special suspension and all that kind of stuff, and they liked my opinions because I knew what the hell it was all about.
Sure.
And another thing is, it always amused me, and it didn't amuse some of the engineers too much, but finally, along there, after Breach and all came in, we had these big engineering meetings, these engineering committees and whatnot. I was just as well acquainted with engine performance and torque curves and about truck motors and gearing and all that sort of thing as they were, and I'd frequently point out things that the engineers didn't know a damn thing about,
mm-hmm.
about the capabilities of a white truck and GM trucks, and
mm-hmm.
and I followed that sort of thing
religiously.
I understood it,
mm-hmm.
and oh man, that would confound them. I mean, it was just they couldn't understand how the hell I'd understood all this damn thing. See,
mm-hmm.
the torque curves and what engine would lug and what engine wouldn't lug. Because I got into all that marine engineering, you know, I had to understand engines and engine performance and things of that kind.
I'm interested that your love of boats and your working with boats and ships was a natural for the kind of atmosphere that you had at Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about some of the styling innovations that you came up with. Now, tell specifically about the bridge. Tell us a bit about that.
Well,
where did that come?
Previously, they had taken templates off the clay models.
How would that work?
Well, they'd take the templates off, full-size templates, and fit them on the drawing board mm-hmm. and trace them out, you know, to get the shapes and the forms.
Right.
And
now, a template is?
It's a cutaway form.
Cutaway.
It's a pattern. It's a pattern.
Yeah,
surface
right.
pattern.
Good.
And mm-hmm. in my work in naval architecture, all hull forms, you set up what's known as a table of offsets.
Mm.
From center line to water lines.
Mm-hmm.
And you can draw a graph of that. In other words,
right.
what I was able to do was to set up a system whereby you could scale a full-size automobile, a model, and put all of the table of offsets in a book.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that could be sent to the pattern shop or the model shop,
mm-hmm.
body die model shop, And the people working on that wouldn't have any concept of what the car looked like. But still, all the dimensions were in there in this book, see?
Uh-huh.
We could send that to the Lincoln plant or to Briggs or what have you, see? All taken off, every inch, see? Mm-hmm. On this modeling bridge, on this track.
And, now, did you build the first bridge for the automobile industry, do you think?
As far as I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as I know.
And that came from your boat building?
Yeah, yeah.
That's how you measure.
It's the way you scale a hull, see? That's the way you draw up a hull of a boat.
Yeah.
Set a line, see?
Marvelous, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, did you have that made special for you?
Yeah, they built them right Rouge in the
to your specifications.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
what did Mr. Ford think about the bridge?
Oh, it was fine. I mean,
of course, he knew a little bit about it from his experience with boats.
I suppose, I don't know, it never became an issue. Uh-huh. They just sort of, we first made one, and then we built two, and three, and four. And, they had various adjustments on them. We could run a car in there and take the offsets It was a natural development.
Certainly
now, of course, that's all done, I guess, with computers and all that kind of stuff.
Well, they're still using...
they're still using the bridges when
the
I was
bridges,
up there.
Oh, yes, right. In fact, they're going to give us one. You're probably your original as a antique.
They're right.
They've got a new one now. But yes, they still use bridges.
I noticed when Evie and I were up there, they took us through there, and they pieced them out, you know, over the longer cars. They lengthened them out.
Mm-hmm.
And... Well, I guess we had 10 or 12 of those bridges, yeah.
Oh, yes.
They were all precision made. They had a V-rail and a little roller bearing wheels on them, you know. Mm-hmm.
Remember who used to make those? What company was the best bridge maker?
They built them right in the Rouge plant.
Oh, yeah.
The tool and die shops, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, they built all that right there.
So what other innovations did you pioneer there at Ford, in the design department?
Well, the two-spoke steering wheel.
Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Up to that time, it was about 1936-37, they had these bicycle spoke steering wheels, you know, mm-hmm. banjo wheels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With all that damn spoke work, I just one day, I think, I'd make a steering wheel that you can look right straight through, and it's simple, you can put your hand on the spokes, you know,
right.
And all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had Jim Lynch, my head machinist, design model shop there.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Jim, turn up a damn ball about this big, see, with the guts of the hub in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, let's put a couple of tapered spokes on it. And we made up one, a handmade one, and I was going to take a vacation then, go down the Eastern Shore, my first wife and myself, and I got a company Ford touring car, 37, I guess it was 37 or 38 touring car. We put all those steering wheels on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped with a couple of dealer friends of mine that I acquainted with, crisscross the country. I'd frequently stop and talk to dealers, you know, and get their opinion of this and that. And that's way nice and smooth, you can see through it. So anyway, Mr. Ford bought the idea, and we came out with that two-spoke steering wheel, which for all intents and purposes is current today, except they got a great big funny-looking padded thing in the middle of the steering wheel. But it was simple, you know. It was just a hub about this big and two nice tapered spokes. Mm-hmm. You just rest your hand on that.
Right.
And cheap, too. Cheap. And Scheller made them, you know. Scheller down in Indiana.
Globe Scheller?
Yeah.
Scheller Globe?
Yeah, I guess that's what it is now.
Yeah, it is now, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right.
But there were all kinds of things we got into. Gee whiz. Matter of fact, the idea of using aluminum foil on the models, you know. First, they made these clay models, they paint aluminum paint, you know,
mm-hmm.
to simulate chrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a Hershey bar one day, and I said, yeah, look at that nice chrome-plated Hershey bar with aluminum foil on there, you know. I told my boy, I said, look, give me a big roll of aluminum foil, see?
Mm-hmm.
He got it from someplace in Detroit, I don't know, a package of candy or something. So we fussed around with that, and found out you could just take a brush, you know, and take that thin aluminum foil and tap it on there with a cloth and
mm-hmm.
brush it, and damn, it looked just like chrome, see?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you roll through, you didn't waste the clay, you just rip that stuff off and threw it away.
I think you're still using it.
Maybe they are. I guess they were at that mm-hmm. time. We were up there, too. It was all kinds of stuff like that, you know, what the hell.
Yeah.
That was the way those ideas come to you, just in the course of events.
Mm-hmm.
No great big earth-shaking thing, but it all adds up.
Well, your
The mercury then, as far as you were concerned, was just a...
Yeah, it was just a... no, there was nothing...
It was really a merchandising effort.
Yes, you know? That's right. The body shape was a little wider and a little easier shape, and, mm-hmm. and the front end was quite Fordish, as Mr. Ford wanted it to be.
Right. Uh-huh.
Someone asked me a while back why they didn't make the front end completely different, a complete breakaway from traditional Ford-type design.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have to understand, when Edsel Ford made up his mind, he wanted something. He wanted it to look like he wanted it to look. He was obstinate as hell.
Do you think that he felt that if he had gone too far overboard in terms of design, that his father might have...
That could be.
...axed the whole thing?
I can't answer that. I've thought of that, but I think... I think the old gentleman left it up pretty much up to Edsel. He had great confidence in Edsel's ability. Edsel had never deviated toward anything radical. I guess the concept of the Lincoln Zephyr was probably the most radical thing that Ford had attempted.
Mm-hmm.
And in as much as that came from an outside source, well, that kind of relieved him, I suppose, from a conscience standpoint.
He never used Charger again, did he?
No.
Or did you?
No.
Did you ever?
No. Uh-huh. No. John kind of faded out of the picture. Then he mm-hmm. he didn't last long. But while the war was coming along there, and I don't know, he got into other kinds of work. And,
yeah.
This book that Lee brought up when he was here, he left a book with me about Jotter's son.
I haven't seen it, no, but I'd love to see it. Yeah.
Yeah. What?
Tom Jr.
Yeah. Tom mm-hmm. Jotter. And about his experiences working for those Italian bodybuilders over there and all that kind of
stuff. Yeah, and others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, God, I mean, he sounded like a wild man. He sounded like he's on pot or something. I mean, it rambles along, and he they set him up to stealing some design for some other outfit or some damn thing. It was just like a comic strip.
Well,
I never knew Jotter's son. I mean, I don't know. I imagine he's a man in his 50s now. He must be.
Yeah.
But old John, he was a playboy. He,
mm-hmm.
yeah, he was a rounder. He was a womanizer. And Edsel Ford never cared for him. Ralph Roberts, on the other hand, Ralph was a little more of a tactful, gentlemanly type. And
he was where?
Spoken. He was with the Briggs.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And he was the product of Tom Hibbert and Ray Dietrich.
Mm-hmm.
It was Hibbert and Dietrich and Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
They started the so-called Baron way back in the early 20s.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They were all a bunch of young body designers in New York, you know, working with custom body people and had worked for them. And
mm-hmm.
Then they set up this Le Baron as a phony name, just a classy name.
Right, yeah.
Ralph Roberts wound up over there with Briggs, and Jotter was there, and Jotter handled mostly the production stuff, and Ralph Roberts was more in the end of selling the custom bodies, Le Baron custom bodies, which Briggs produced then, to various Chrysler and Packard and different ones, including Lincoln. I guess they built some quite nice Lincoln convertible coupes.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you like the Zephyr design?
I never cared much for it. I mm-hmm. I'd never designed cars like that myself. I hadn't up till that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't develop much enthusiasm for that.
Mm-hmm.
No one had ever requested a car like that, and the concept didn't appeal to me too much then. I knew it had its place, and I think the car would have been more appropriate probably with the rear engine at that time, as Jotter had originally conceived it.
It would have been, yes.
The car wasn't a good car on the road. It was too nose heavy, and it was too light on the rear end.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I can recall many a slippery night out there in Devon, mm-hmm. with the ice on the road, driving out to Plymouth or something like that. You were awful careful. You had to be awfully careful in applying the power to the rear wheels. The thing would just simply spin out of it, mm-hmm. just fishtail, unless there were two or three people in the rear of it.
Yeah.
It was a poorly balanced car. And, of course, the car was very poor mechanically. That mm-hmm. engine was awful.
Yes.
It was just a scaled-down version of that old, big old 12-cylinder Lincoln, which was always out of balance. It had a whip in it at certain speeds, vibration periods, and beautifully built engine, and meticulously built, but it wasn't a long life engine.
Mm-hmm.
And Lord, compared to the Cadillac V12 or the Packard, it was rough.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the old first V8 Lincolns were rough. It felt just like a good white truck engine. It had a tremor when you held the steering wheel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good tough engine, but not a beautiful silky smooth engine.
Mm-hmm.
And poor old Frank Johnson, I guess time had passed him by. It was a 60 degree engine. And it was just inherently out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know Edsel Ford. I don't know how enthused he ever was about it, but I know it wasn't the best piece of engineering in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful to look at, and it was beautifully finished.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't stint a thing on quality.
But it was all skin deep.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And of course, the Zephyr was a dog. I mean, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And the pitiful thing was, it came out with a Continental, and it looked like a sporty car that should have a little get up and go to it, and Lord, it was a real dog on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That engine was all mush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I told him one day, I was talking to one of the boys, I said, God, if you put a nice big straight 8 Buick in this engine in the car, and he'd really have something, you know, or a good lugging engine.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the Continental, Bob. So you've got this, you've done these two hand jobs, and you've brought out the...
Well, now there was a call, there was a demand for a hard top, you know,
right.
After the first was a convertible.
Yes.
And
very successful.
Yeah, the visibility wasn't very good out of it, you know, with
mm-hmm.
that big, deep back quarter on it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we were asked to develop a hardtop version, and we just simply took the lower shell and clayed up a roof
mm-hmm.
over the one of the
right.
production shells, and there was no big deal there.
Was that the Cabriolet?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that outsold the convertible 2-3-1. Yeah.
It was very popular.
Yeah. Well, the convertible, you're never able to get rid of all the shakiness in the cowl because of the lack of a solid frame. In other words, it had a very weak frame.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a matter of fact, it was built out of a unit construction car. See, once you took the roof strength out of it, you didn't have anything.
Right.
Had to beef up the chassis frame disproportionately and put a lot of extra weight, I don't know, hundreds of pounds of extra weight
mm-hmm.
to stabilize it. Strengthen it, see, for the loss of the roof rail. And so that it had a strike against it there, the fact that it was underpowered. But people were well pleased with the car. I mean, it was no performer. It looked like a fast car, but it was a safe car to drive, let's put it that way. You couldn't break your neck in it too fast.
When it first came out, the 1940 model, as I recall, still had the word Zephyr on the...
I guess at first, the first advertising was convertible Zephyr,
convertible.
A special, yeah. Yeah, the Continental name came along. That was Edsel Ford's name that he put on it once we decided on production.
Story goes that you and he used to talk about European cars.
Yeah.
And he would say, yes, the Continental look or something like that.
Yeah, well, he had a taste for European type
right.
design styling, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, well, that car, I don't think it didn't exhibit a heck of a lot of that. I mean, it was simple, like some of the custom bodies were over there, and some
mm-hmm.
were quite gaudy, you know, some
right.
of those German bodies and whatnot.
Yeah.
But in my concept, in my mind, it wasn't designed to look like a foreign car particularly. The form was already pre-cast using the components that we did see.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens a happy combination.
Yeah, worked out very well.
Yeah, there really wasn't much design to it. It just fell together.
Mm-hmm.
And we happened to have a nice looking front end, and the fenders were nice, and by the time you squished it down and raked the windshield a little
mm-hmm.
more, well, you had your car, see?
Mm-hmm. Gorgeous.
It would have probably, if we decided to gussy it up and put a lot of icing on it and tutti frutti like General Motors, we'd have probably had more design problems. It was just so simple it couldn't help but look nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has a gorgeous body.
Oh yeah, it had nice body form, and by the time you extended the hood back and stretched the fenders out, why, there wasn't much you could do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the platform, the sill and all was Zephyr sill.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that little chubby trunk on the back there wasn't anything you want to travel with. You had to scratch your belly and lean down in there to put anything in it.
You're putting the spare tire in the deck lid, so to speak, gave you much more room in the trunk, didn't you?
Well, no, that tire was completely outside. That never did get in the body.
Right, yeah.
Except later on, they put that hump in there, you know.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But the first Continental, it was just a bracket just hung between the bumper and the body.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
With a cover on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, there was no problem there.
The 40 model is very successful.
Ford, now you're talking about. Oh, no, the
Continental.
Oh, now, yes. We, let's see, the first one was the 40 and 41.
Right.
Yeah. And then just before the war started, we designed the 42, the heavier front end.
Now, that was a completely new, a completely radical front end change.
Well, we had to use the basic Zephyr body. That was the original body designed back in 35,
right.
Mm-hmm. 7 years later.
Right.
And, in the meantime, Cadillac had gotten a beefier look. All their General Motors cars had beefed up so they looked heavier and a little more important on the road. Compared to that, the old Zephyr looked like a hungry horse. I mean, gee, that razorback hood, you know, and those skinny fenders and little skinny bumpers. Well, that's another thing that people have asked me many times. Gee, why don't they put heavier bumpers, you know, all that? Well, Edsel Ford didn't like that effect. He wanted something delicate looking, see?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He liked fine moldings.
Yeah.
He liked delicate touches. He didn't want anything heavy and ponderous. Like General Motors, all those jukebox things they put on Oldsmobiles and Buicks, you know, those big old heavy chunks of chrome.
Yeah.
Oh my God, he never would go for that.
Mm.
And he said no. He looked at an instrument panel one day, or some kind of a grain they showed on an instrument panel. He said, "Oh, gee, that looks pukey, doesn't it?" he had some funny expressions he'd use, you know. I finally told him that the car in its price range has got to look a little more important on the road. And so that's when we developed that new hood and the new fenders and so on, which went quite well with the body. The body began to look a little skinny, but they went well on the Continental. They look good on the Continental.
Was this the 42 front end design?
Yeah, 42, yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And that, of course, carried over into the 46, 47, 48 post-war cars. Yeah.
At this point, Mr. Ford is getting, Mr. Edsel and Mr. Henry Ford are both getting into war work, aren't they?
That's right.
And so your department is...
We thinned down, we turned over many of our draftsmen and designers and engineers to war work. We worked on plane turrets, interchangeability of turrets, making mock-ups for the bombing turrets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We did some camouflage work, and... as well as carrying on a certain amount of design work on a small scale.
Did you bring your crew with you into war work, pretty much?
Yeah. We turned over some went to Willow Run, you know, to do drafting work, and several of our modelers went out there to do modeling on fuselage conversion pieces and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we kept a small staff going there.
Now, while you were working on war components or military procurement, you were attempting to keep the design spirit alive by doing some mock-ups.
That's right.
Plays.
That's right. We did some clay work and some small scale model work, and a lot of pictures and stuff like that, enough to keep Mr. Ford's interest going. As a matter of fact, when he died, it was we were just getting well into post-war. Concepts.
Right.
And
he had some very ambitious plans for, along with yourself, being prepared for the end of the war.
He stressed the necessity for production follow-up after the war. He could see the necessity for that, so they allowed us a reasonable scope there to keep things moving so we wouldn't be caught completely unprepared. But he died in spring of 43, and I had quite a lot of stuff saved up. I went a couple of months trying to get a hold of him, you know, to find out whether he was going to be back with us or not. And I called up, spoke with Mr. Lapine, his private secretary, and he said, well, Mr. Ford had gone down to Hope Sound.
Mm-hmm.
on his vacation, and he came back, oh, I guess, along toward the end of March.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was, he came in my back door unannounced, and D.I.Z. looked terrible. He was tanned and had, but he lost a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm. Yes, looked a bit
and,
gone.
He used to show me these bottles of pills, you know, he used to carry, and they, I said, why don't you go over to the Eastern Shore of Maryland and buy a nice big farm over there and just go over there and spend all the damn time you want. I said, this thing will hold together.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I wish I could.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, he'd come up to you with those little, you know, and I'd talk back and forth with him
mm-hmm.
about that, and
yeah.
Not that I'd have any influence on it.
Well, I think you were a good influence. You complimented his taste and design.
That's right. That's right. We had a good balanced way of working things out, and I understood his preferences, and he had a lot of definite preferences.
Mm-hmm.
And when he liked something, he'd say so, and when he didn't like it, he'd say he didn't like it. That was
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
And he could tell very quickly, and I could tell very quickly whether you could sell him on it or not. I got to know certain things that were acceptable to him, and
mm-hmm.
he didn't like anything that was heavy and bulldozer looking or anything like that. I mean, that was
keep it simple.
Keep it simple. Keep it light. Keep it
mm-hmm.
delicate.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas the other people, well, that styling has lasted better. That has a much more attraction today. It's grown old gracefully, put
right.
it that way, see.
Exactly. Yeah.
Some of these old Packards and some of these old General Motors cars, these look ridiculous. I mean, they and at that time, I always thought, gee, well, maybe this is a little on the skimpish side. And he liked light bumpers. He didn't like great big thick bumpers and
mm-hmm.
great big bumper guards. Like some of those Cadillac things, you know, Christ, they look like a football. Some of those
mm-hmm.
big bumper guards he used
mm-hmm.
to put on there.
Yeah, horrible.
He never cared for that. That, of course, is one thing that appealed to him about the Continental. It was sleek and clean and simple.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And Briggs, on the other hand, everything Briggs tried to show him followed the usual trend. I mean, they
yeah.
did a lot of Chrysler work, you know, and they
yeah.
wanted all that garish decoration and tutti-frutti hung on.
What did you think of the Chrysler Airflow? You must remember that.
Yes, I do very well. I never thought much about it. I mean, it was an ugly damn thing, and I knew it. It was well-engineered, and it had certain airflow characteristics. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was easy on the air, pushing the wind,
mm-hmm.
and